There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look into all the grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmodel, and I'm your host. On today's program, the digital TV transition's a-coming, and people, they's getting scared. Also, the Illinois Attorney General's taking a look at AT&T's treatment of public access TV in the state of Illinois. All that, it's a big news update. Do stay tuned. Well, we're into a new quarter here at Northwestern University, WNUR, which is the home of the Media Geek radio program, and producer Andrew Gotthelf is back in the chair today. I'm glad he could join us again.
Thanks. Always nice to get back to Evanston after a long time away from campus. You know, it's nice to come back and feel that frigid air once again.
Yes, feel the frigid air here in the in just north of Chicago. And I want to talk for a minute or two before we dive into the news here, because you had a pretty exciting opportunity over the winter break here around the new year to actually broadcast the Alamo Bowl.
Yes, as you know, I work for the sports department of WNUR, and we're one of the, I like to think, one of the best student-run sports departments that we have in the country, and that we, you know, follow Northwestern athletics, and we all around the country, you know, football, basketball, you name it, and we really get great access to these teams because of the reputation that we've built up. And so we were able to go down to San Antonio the 27th, 28th, 29th for the Northwestern Missouri game, and had just an awesome time. I mean, the game was a disappointing finish, but besides that, the way we were treated as credentialed members of the media was really cool. I mean, our press pass said nothing other than press. You know, the same thing that professional radio stations and TV stations, they got the same thing that we did. We were, you know, had access to press conferences and notes and everything that you could have asked for. And we're just college students. It was really, really cool.
Do you know of any other college stations that do bowl broadcast, that have the same play-by-play live on their stations?
I don't know off the top of my head. What I think what's interesting is that a lot of people were touting Northwestern Missouri as the journalism bowl, because Columbia, and there's a very good journalism program there. And when we were going through the process of applying for credentials, the head media guy for the Alamo Bowl was worried that there weren't going to be enough spots, because WNUR, he expected to be there, and the Missouri Student Radio expected to be there, and they were not there. They didn't show up. So that's one for the Medill School of Journalism, I guess.
And WNUR.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, I was just thinking about, you know, sports and sports broadcasting, because in addition to, you know, the big Big Ten sports, you know, like football and basketball, your sports department also covers a lot of other sports, almost more than can fit into the radio schedule, right?
Yeah, we also, you know, we do football and men's basketball, but those get covered by WGN as well. They have a contract to do those games, so we're not the primary carrier of them, but the women's basketball team, the baseball team, the softball team, and the women's lacrosse team, we're all exclusive radio carriers for those sports. So really, I mean, with the addition of the Big Ten Network, fans once in a while can have access to these teams, but, you know, we provide most of the content, most of the coverage of these teams, and I think that that's something special that we're able to offer to people.
Do you get any feedback from, you know, the teams themselves, especially, say, the teams that aren't used to getting much media coverage, like women's lacrosse, which is a championship team here at Northwestern? I mean, do you get feedback from the coaches or the players?
Yeah, I think the women's lacrosse team is the team that appreciates what we've done the most, because they're we've been there through their rise to prominence, and their coach absolutely loves us. If it was up to her, we would do every game of the women's lacrosse team home and away. Unfortunately, we don't have the money or staff to do that, but we took our first road trip with women's lacrosse last year outside of the postseason to Duke, and they were just so excited to be having this coverage, because, you know, they're ambassadors for the sport as well. Women's athletics doesn't get the coverage that the men's sports do, and so any press, I think, is good press for them, and we like to take advantage of that opportunity to provide it for them.
Well, there's a real, I mean, people often forget there's a real political side, and I think a real cultural, sociocultural side to sports, in addition to the big name and the big money, although there's elements there. You learn a lot about the culture through sports, and I know that especially amongst women's college sports, there's this very high correlation between high-achieving athletes and high-achieving scholarship. And it's often, I think, a shame that that the women's basketball or women's lacrosse don't get the sort of attention that men's basketball and football get, especially, you know, in a Big Ten school like Northwestern, where you have some really intense competition and some very good teams,
and
great athletes.
One of the reasons I think that Northwestern has been able to be so successful in these non-revenue sports is because the education obviously is great. And a lot of these programs or sports don't have professional leagues, mm-hmm. you know, high-paying professional leagues that these athletes can go into. So they need an education to fall back on, and Northwestern happens to be
a good place,
a good choice to do it. Whereas the basketball and football programs, a lot of times these high-profile, you know, athletes who have dreams of professional sports, they want to go to the Ohio States and the Floridas and the Oklahomas, where they're going to get the most exposure mm-hmm. To pro scouts. And Northwestern at this moment is not necessarily able to provide that for everyone.
And of course, you use that word non-revenue sports.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which could be a whole nother conversation to get into that whole side of sports, and especially in the NCAA and how that relates to the economics of higher education and the television. I mean, it's a pretty complex beast, and so it's interesting to see WNUR in there. And where I went to school was a Division III, so obviously not a lot of interest in the sports teams, men or women's, by, you know, mainstream news organizations, just local papers primarily interested. So my college radio station, of course, did coverage of all the major sports teams, men's and women's, because without it, there really wouldn't be coverage.
Right. Someone's got to let them know what happened.
Exactly. So what's interesting is that at WNUR, which I think stands out amongst, Division I teams, Division I schools, has radio stations able to go along and provide that coverage, not just to the less covered sports, but also to the basketball and football. And I think also, because you cover men's basketball and football, it kind of gives you the ability to do these other sports, because you get some prominence, you can bring in more volunteers, and obviously there's a funding angle.
Right. People are not necessarily joining to cover the women's lacrosse team, but they find out that it's a lot of fun too. Syracuse is a school that I know has a very good student radio station, but
yeah.
At least one of their student radio stations is an NPR station. So not all of their funding, like WNUR, is necessarily coming.
Well, yeah. Some universities have both a college student-run station and they run as well a public service station. I mean, there's a lot of breakdowns like that. And certainly, if any Media Geek listeners want to tell us, if you know about some stations that we're missing or some other things, I'm always glad to know more. Just send me, drop me a line, email paul@mediageek.net. Love to learn more about any stations you know about, especially college stations that do some more high-profile sports or some very interesting things maybe with local sports or local athletics, because it's certainly a whole important part of our cultural landscape as well. So thanks Andrew, for updating us about some of your fun stuff there over the course of the winter break. Now we're going to get into a little bit of news, something I try to do every so often here in a Media Geek radio program is to take some time aside and really run down some, I think, what are very important stories about our media environment. And they, you know, some of these stories do get some mainstream media coverage, though they don't always show up, though, on the front page. They often show up on the business pages, even though it's really about core communications to support our democracy and our ability to really have rich civic lives and to function well within a democracy. It's still just treated based upon business and whether or not stocks are up or the kind of money that's coming in. And one topic that I've been covering quite a bit this year on Media Geek is the digital TV transition. It's right around the corner now. We're at the beginning of January, and February 17th is a date when those analog TV transmitters get turned off. The television goes digital only, and if you have an analog TV set and you have an antenna, you don't have cable, you don't have satellite, and you haven't gotten a converter box, February 17th, you will not get television anymore on that television. We're actually with a few exceptions. But primarily when you talk about the big networks, you talk about your major broadcasters, you won't get anything. And so there's been this program that's been run by the federal government where you can get a coupon towards the purchase of a digital TV converter box, because this is a forced transition, right? This is transition forced by federal law that your analog TV sets become obsolete. And so it's a $40 voucher towards the purchase of a converter box, and converter boxes cost $50 to $60 that you can get from the federal government. Well, consumers who apply for federal coupons now are being placed on a waiting list because they're out. And that's according to the Commerce Department, which is running the program. And that's as of Monday, January 5th. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the arm of the Commerce Department administering the coupon program, created the waiting list on Sunday after hitting a $1.34 billion funding limit set by Congress. The agency will send out coupons to those on the list only as unredeemed coupons currently in circulation expire, freeing up more money for the program. The waiting list already has requests for 103,000 coupons. And Meredith Atwell Baker, head of the NTIA, urged consumers now requesting coupons not to wait for them to arrive and to instead act quickly to ensure that they have at least one television set ready for the February 17th transition. So in response, Representative Ed Markey, who is now the outgoing chairman of the House Telecommunications and Internet Subcommittee, is working on legislation that would give the NTIA a waiver in order to allow it to continue to send out coupons for converter boxes, even while outstanding unused coupons have yet to expire. Markey is also reportedly considering a move to delay the transition. And now the National Association of Broadcasters, which is the lobby representing all the major commercial broadcasters in the country, they're asking the Congress and the FCC to do something about the backlog of digital TV converter box coupon requests. And Public Broadcasting Chief, PBS, Public Broadcasting Service Television, Paula Kerger, also is calling for action on the issue. First in line, though, is the Consumers Union, who you may know published Consumer Reports magazine. And they are calling for a delay as well. They're the first ones on the block with that, citing concern about the number of call centers and assistance to viewers. The FCC has call centers set up so people can call and say, what the heck happened to my analog TV? How come I can't see anything any longer? In a letter to Congress on the issue, the Consumers Union observes, quote, the United Kingdom is spending close to $400 million to educate a population one-fifth the size of the U.S. about its digital broadcast transition, end quote. In December, FCC Chair Kevin Martin told Ed Markey that the commission will spend $10 million for its call center and various outsourced operations. The in-house center will be able to handle 12,000 calls a day using a staff of 2,300 call handlers. The outside operations should be able to field about 350,000 calls a day from February 15th through 21st, Chairman Martin estimates. And now President-elect Obama has joined the chorus calling for a delay of the digital TV transition. John Podesta, the co-chair of his transition team, has voiced support for the idea of allowing more converter coupons to be issued, and he's also calling for allocating more money to fund the coupon program.
It sounds like this program needs a bailout.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Get bailing. You can use your rabbit ears. You can't move very much with that, though. Do you have television?
Yes, I'm fine. I don't have an analog TV. My question is, when people, whenever this happens, when they turn on their TVs, those that don't have not converted, what will they see? Will they just see static? Will they see a message to call somebody?
Well, so that'll bring us into our next story. But for most stations, they'll see nothing. They will see static. The FCC has proposed in the last minute rulemaking, proposed in December, having what they call a nightlight program, where a couple of the broadcasters in a few markets would be allowed to keep their analog transmitters on, pretty much just running a message that says analog broadcasting is ended. You now need to watch our digital channel. For more information, go to this website, call this number, etc. And but it's only a few because, you know, you recall we've been talking about for the last few months is that all that spectrum, all those channels being given up by the broadcasters is going to be turned in all sorts of new services, right, for digital, for wireless internet, for emergency communication services, all sorts of other things. So, you know, they're really trying to oust the broadcasters out of that analog spectrum. So it's only a few, and it's only going to be 30 days currently. So, you know, basically to March 17th or so. But the National Association of Broadcasters is asking the FCC to expand the number of stations eligible to have these nightlight signals on the air, in addition to streamlining the application process to stay on the air. So right now they have to file an extra application in order to do that. FCC will only approve a few, and apparently it's quite a few hurdles to go over. Now, if the one of the reasons that the broadcasters are saying they want this is obviously they think, you know, people would like to they'll inform more consumers, more people know about it. But lest we think it's all about public information, the NAB is also proposing to let broadcasters sell ads.
Of course,
on these broadcasts. Of course. the FCC's proposal for the nightlight limits, programming to public service and emergency messages. So there might be, you know, an amber alert or, you know, weather alerts. And it specifically excludes commercials. But broadcasters also want the freedom to air educational videos, in air quotes, about digital TV analog converter box setups produced by individual manufacturers. So meaning Magnavox, Philips, Sony can air their informational videos about set-top boxes. So they're pushing the FCC in that direction, which is interesting because in order for there to be more channels running analog, essentially the FCC has to loosen its requirements, its interference requirements, which is something the NAB usually argues against. Usually they're very interference phobic, shall we say. And in this case, it seems like they're not so worried about it.
Well, if it's going to benefit them, then they're okay with it, but only then, not until.
You know, and they are crying, saying, you know, keeping that analog transmitter on, you know, will cost money, of course. You know, it's relatively expensive to run a full-power television transmitter, and so they'll need to sell the ads to offset that that cost. Now, the broadcasters are not required to run nightlight. Rather, the FCC is providing a provision that they may be allowed to do so should they ask. So it's not like there's any particular gun to their head. And I do want to make a note, you know, regarding this call to delay, as long as 4 months, delay the transition to digital television is our pal Matthew Lassar. I like to call our man who watches the FCC from a undisclosed basement in the San Francisco Bay Area. And a piece he recently wrote for Ars Technica reporting on these calls to delay. He's actually advocated against it. And you know, Matthew Lassar is a friend of the public interest, definitely a friend of the American consumer. He definitely writes from that standpoint. But he says that, you know, so far they've done a couple tests, such as North Carolina, where they actually did a full turn off and went all digital to see what kind of reaction they got from the public, and the reaction was relatively muted. It seemed like people were actually relatively well aware and relatively well prepared, and that mostly Matthew is worried about delays to implementing wireless internet because, you know, 2 months turns into 4 months, and then you reach the end of that 4 months, and then everyone starts filing more petitions to extend, and the broadcasters want another 30 days. The next thing you know, you're into 12, 24 months. And I don't necessarily disagree with Matthew on the slippery slope of delaying the digital TV transition. Unfortunately, it seems to me that in a lot of ways, it's not been handled well. I don't know if you noticed recently, and only within the last couple of months, there's been a lot more advertisements on television.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say, especially on regular, you know, Fox, CBS, ABC. And it's interesting how they're doing that.
Okay. They were required to do that by the FCC.
They're using superstars and saying, you're not going to be able to watch so-and-so on this show if you don't convert, which I think is not a bad way to go about doing it.
But it's interesting that they didn't really seem to become all that prominent until relatively recently. And, of course, how many times did it take for the message to sink into somebody, especially, you know, if they flip through commercials or channel surf a lot, and now they go to go get their coupon.
And there's none.
You know, and you know, for a lot of folks who, you know, who might be middle class and, you know, $40 may not be a lot, but for a lot of, you know, poor folks who disproportionately rely on over-the-air broadcasts, it may be a lot more of a burden to spend the money on the converter and going through the technical setup. And, you know, while we can criticize television and television watching all we like, people still do get a lot of news, get a lot of local information, get emergency information, especially in times of severe weather or other sorts of things. Television is there. And up to now, it's been, you know, free and over the air. So, you know, I find myself kind of sitting on the fence here. And from a policy side, you know, it seems not to have been handled very well. And as a consumer union note, they're going to spend a lot more alerting people about the switch over to digital television in Britain than they will in the U.S. by a factor of like 40. And, you know, for a country which is just a fraction the size of the U.S. So it'll be very interesting to see, but I think that we'll be reporting in the next few weeks of Media Geek a lot of churn on this issue as it's finally coming to the public consciousness and our elected officials start getting rather upset about it. And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reis Manil, and I'm your host. And Andrew Gotthalf, producer, is here sitting in the engineer's chair holding things down. Check out Media Geek online at mediageek.net. And you get the radio program at radio.mediageek.net. It's a podcast, or you can download it, or you can just listen in your browser. And over at the Media Geek blog, I mean, and I'll probably be taking up digital TV pretty quick here. I got some more opinions to get out of me. But lately, I've been taking up the whole issue of planned obsolescence. Recently, there was this LA Times news story declaring it's the death of VHS. VHS videotape is going down the tubes. Which actually, I'm sorry, the LA Times article didn't say that. The LA Times article was about a distributor. The last distributor of new movies on VHS is giving up on it. And then all the subsequent meta reporting was, oh my God, VHS is dead. We're all screwed. So I have some thoughts about that, some thoughts about film and digital photography. So if you want to get some geekier kind of stuff, that's going on at the Media Geek blog right now, mediageek.net. And, of course, there's the Media Geek Twitter feed. It's at twitter.com/mediageek. A couple more listeners have said hello, including a Shoreve listener out in UK who gets it by podcast. So they've been saying hello by Twitter. So that's twitter.com/mediageek. You can message me there if you're a Twitter user, or you can also go to send me the old-fashioned email, paul@mediageek.net. Well, here's a story about the state of the press in these troubling times. Relevant to the local area here in the Chicago area where Media Geek originates, but I think kind of relevant to everyone. In another sign of hard times for newspapers, Chicago's Sun-Times Media Group announced that it plans to close down 12 of its suburban newspapers, along with laying off 15 unionized workers in its suburban newsrooms. The papers to be closed are published by the Sun-Times Pioneer Press Division and mostly serve the northwest suburbs, including the Arlington Heights Post, the Des Plaines Times, the Elk Grove Times, the Hoffman Estates Review, the Mount Prospect Times, the Palatine Countryside, Rolling Meadows Review, Schaumburg Review, and Wheeling Countryside. Pioneer Press, acquired by Sun-Times in 1989, currently publishes 51 papers serving Chicago's suburbs. Sun-Times Media reported a $168 million loss in the third quarter. The company hopes to cut another $50 million in expenses this year and asks members of all of its unions to take a 7% cut in compensation to help reach that goal. Sun-Times Media trimmed $50 million in expenses last year, a move that included dozens of newsroom layoffs and the closure of a handful of papers. But those cuts weren't enough to restore profitability. The company says the additional $50 million in expense reductions should bring it back to break even. I mean, the thing here is that what we see is that a part of this is although, you know, you see cuts in the big newspaper, the big city newspaper, it's really the coverage to the suburbs. You know, not everything that happens in Chicago is necessarily as important when you live in these towns as some things that happen in municipal government, crime, or other things that happen, you know, in the suburbs. And with this, there'll be decreasing coverage in a direct local fashion, as well as decreasing coverage back to the mother newspaper. And this is another sad fact of what's happening in the newspaper business, but I contend is also part of the consolidation that preceded all of this. I don't know, is this coming up at all in any of your journalism classes?
Yeah, we took a class my freshman year entitled Intro to 21st Century Media, which pretty much cried out for the loss of newspapers, and I think scared a lot of people who came in to Medill thinking they were going to be newspaper writers and sort of shied them away from that industry. But they also talked about this sort of hyper-local coverage and said that, you know, it's all going to go online. I mean, somebody's going to find, hopefully, is going to find a way to make that sort of coverage profitable. It's really been unbelievable to me watching how slow these newspapers have been to change themselves and find that business model that fits online. It's like they're like dinosaurs and trying to move in that direction. And just now they're starting to realize that once they're losing so much money that they need to try something else because what they're doing right now is not working.
And the Sun-Times Group not being quite as big, but you know, when you talk about it, I mean, Sun-Times Media Group bought these papers, and now it's shutting them down. I do think there's an element of bloat, of bloating, and then having, you know, leveraging yourself incredibly, which is really what happened with the Tribune Company, so that you're carrying much more debt. You have certain redundancies, and you need to trim down. And then when profits get thinner, it gets much harder to maintain. So I do think that the few still local independently newspapers are probably weathering a little better. Partially because they didn't have such huge profit expectations, but they're not also trying to balance out a portfolio of properties across the country. And one last piece of news I definitely want to get to, because I've promised everyone about it, is that Attorney General Lisa Madigan of Illinois is now investigating complaints that AT&T's new U-verse cable TV service is violating the law by shortchanging public access educational and government channels, also called PEG channels for short. The complaints regard AT&T's method of aggregating all local PEG channels onto a single digital channel. So then, in order to watch a particular channel, like in Chicago, CanTV, or a municipal channel that might be in one of the suburbs, viewers have to select the local aggregate channel, then go through a second menu to select the one they want to watch. And then if they want to go watch, you know, regular old channel like CBS or NBC, they have to get out of that menu and go back. Critics say that as a result of this system, PEG channels can take as nearly as long as a minute to load. It's worse than YouTube. It also takes longer to switch back, making it nearly impossible to channel surf the local PEG channels. PEG channel operators and producers also claim that public access channels aren't being broadcast with the same quality as other channels on U-verse, meaning they're trying to cram more into the same amount of bandwidth. So it's, you know, sort of like, again, like crappy YouTube videos. AT&T, though, counters that it's just following the law. It's doing what's consistent with Illinois law. And the reason why the Attorney General is even looking into such a case is that in 2007, Illinois established a statewide franchise for new cable TV services from telephone and telecom companies. And this is something that used to be negotiated on a local municipal level. So Chicago would negotiate a contract, or Palatine would negotiate a contract, or Bolingbrook would negotiate a contract individually. Now it just is negotiated statewide. Illinois state franchise law is arguably one of the more consumer and public interest friendly compared to a lot of other states, especially Texas and Pennsylvania, which are amongst the first to happen. It contains relatively strong protections for public access, government, and educational channels, but it certainly looks like AT&T is going to try to see how far they can push the limits on this. Well, that brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in 1 week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. That's the home to the Media Geek blog, and the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. You can subscribe to the podcast, or you can download MP3 versions of the program, or you can just listen in your browser in case you want to catch it when you missed it, you want to listen again, or that's how you like to listen. all at MediaGeek.net. If you do Twitter, you can track my tweets about our media environment, and you can actually tweet back if you got any comments at twitter.com/MediaGeek, or you can do the old-fashioned email, paul@MediaGeek.net. Thank you for tuning in.